Are we hot? Mm-hmm. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here today, and it's an honor and a pleasure for us to be here to present to you. Let me introduce my colleague, Jan Engelsberg, and my name is Joseph Idzorek. We are both program managers in the Azure SQL Database team based in Redmond, Washington. And today we're going to talk about predictable performance within Azure SQL Database and also a new feature that we've recently released called Elastic Scale. And to start the presentation off, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to show a demo first. We're going to use this demo to set the context for the rest of the presentation. And at the conclusion of the presentation, we'll come back to this demo. So within Azure SQL Database, and specifically between our two teams, we have a metaphor that we call a particular workload for customers. We call it Coke bottling is the scenario. And handy that they have Coke bottles here for us to drink. And the scenario is really such that within a particular workload, you can fill up a database. And once you fill up that physical database, then you want to provision a new database, and we'll fill that up. So it's very similar to Coke bottles going down a conveyor line. You fill up the database, next Coke bottle comes in, you fill that one up. So within the demo that we're going to show today, what we've actually done in our team is we've created an nlog target for Elastic Scale that will actually write logs to Azure SQL Database using the new Elastic Scale feature. So I'm going to start the workload. And this is just it's a small workload. It's a single-threaded application. But what this is going to highlight, we show here, and we'll talk about this a little bit more deeply in the Elastic Scale part, is we have a shard map manager, we have a shard map, and then we have our one basic database. And the way that this application is configured is that when the CPU for the basic database goes above 85%, this will turn red. And we'll say, well, it would be really great if we have a basic database if we could scale that vertically, right? We want to scale to, say, an S0 performance level. And once it gets that S0 performance level, we're going to cap it for the purpose of this demo. Really, this scenario would take place over the course of time periods of days, maybe weeks, to fill up a 500 gigabyte database. But for the purpose of this demonstration, we're going to cap that size at 330 kilobytes. So we're going to get above, so we've gone up to S0, the CPU has relinquished because we've added more performance, and once we get up to that 330, we're going to provision a new database and scale out. So the important thing to note here is both scaling up and scaling out, and we'll come back to this workload at the end of the demo and show the progress that it's made over the course of the presentation. So a couple things also that are happening here is the application is agnostic to how many shards we have, and we're also querying the new DMV released within the new editions that Jan will talk about that provide near real-time statistics every 15 seconds of the workload that your database is presenting. So you can see here now that we've provisioned the next shard, we've realized that the workload was more than what a basic could handle, we've scaled up that particular shard, and then for cost optimization reasons, we actually scaled down that other basic. And we'll let that thing run. So, switch over. So, within the presentation today, Jan will be talking about predictable performance or the ability to vertical scale up and down an individual database, and then I will continue on with Elastic Scale to horizontally scale database tier in and out, and then we'll come back to the demo.
All right, thank you very much, Joe, for getting the session started. As you just said, I'll be talking about the predictable performance part, so and this will include the scale up and down part. And so those are the points that I'm going to go over in the first part of the presentation. So the first thing I want to talk about is why did we actually introduce those new service tiers? What was the reasoning behind it? The second thing that I'm going to go through is a handful of concepts that we use to describe these and how we actually define these. Then I will be talking a little bit around how to choose performance levels. I'll talk about briefly on quota management. We made some changes there, and then you will see a demo at the end of my part of the presentation. So jumping straight in, who has used Web and Business databases before? All right, so a handful of people. Anybody using the new ones yet? All right, so roughly the same set of people. So the reason why we made a change is because a huge part of our customer base actually came to us and said, hey, Those web and business databases, they are great. However, they are not very predictable with regards to the performance. And the reason for this is when we introduced SQL database, we came out with a business model that was based on the amount of storage that you use. So you paid for the gigabytes that you store, and we would give you the resources, or we would give you as many resources as we have to fulfill your query needs. Well, it turns out that database workloads tend to actually use a lot of resources. And on the machines that we run those databases on, we get into crunches, right? So performance is shared, and we get into these noisy neighbor situations. Anybody, and I will show on the next slide what this actually means. Anybody who has used web and business for a long time might actually have experienced this. So you run a workload, and then all of a sudden, your throughput drops, and nothing goes again. And in the worst case scenario, we had a mechanism that is called throttling that would actually prevent you from issuing new queries until the machine recovers. And there were two types of throttling. One was called soft throttling. The other one was called hard throttling. So soft throttling is when the system thinks that you are actually one of those noisy guys on the node. It will actually stop you so that other people can get resources. Or in the worst case, if the machines get overloaded, it would just stop everybody on that machine from running further workloads. So you can see, from a customer perspective, if you run into these kind of situations, it's not a very great experience. And so we went and deprecated those for 2015 in September. So if you run databases on the web and business queues, you can continue to do so until September 2015. And what we did is we introduced the basic, standard, and premium service tiers. So premium has been around for quite some time. It has been in preview, and then we added the basic and standard service tiers to it. And the difference is that we now don't charge you for storage anymore, but we charge you for the performance that you use. So you need to go in, and you'll see later there's a set of performance levels that you can choose from, and the storage is for free, right? So you don't need to worry about the storage that you use anymore. What we also introduced is the concept, what we call resource governance, rather than this throttling mechanism. So it's a different way of assuring the performance that you get, and I will talk about this concept as well. And using this resource governance mechanism, we assure the predictability in the system. So you will see that when you use the new service tiers, these noisy neighbor problems essentially are completely gone, right? So you can run at any point in time, and you will always get the same throughput. Those were in general available in September, and they're fully backwards compatible with the exception of federations, and this is where Joe will come in later and talk about the elastic scale part. All right. So predictable performance, whoever was in the overview session on Tuesday has already seen this slide. I just want to show this again to re-emphasize how the system works and what is the difference that we have introduced. So this is how it used to be in web and business. All databases run on a machine, and as long as everybody is behaving, everything is good, you get your resources, you can use a little more, a little less, and you get a great experience. However, if now one database puts a huge load on it, right? It takes over all the resources on the machine. Well, then you get into this kind of picture. This guy gets a great experience, right? He runs a load test or went live with the application. Everything is great. However, all the other guys on the machine get only very little. And this kind of state can actually remain like this. And you can see how this is a bad experience for everybody. And at some point, the system might detect, hey, you know, there are other databases try to get resources and then throttle the big guy. Or if the system thinks, hey, it's the load on the machine is getting so critical that, you know, we have to back up on it and make sure that the machine stays healthy, we would have to throttle everybody. So what we did conceptually, we put like, instead of running everything in one big machine, you can think of it, we put like little bounding boxes around those databases, and we contain the database load within those bounding boxes. So now what happens is the databases, they can't put more load into it, right, but they can't get out of their bounding box, and so they can't impact anybody else on this machine. So this concept was introduced with the premium databases some time back. It was in preview, as I said, for a while. And we took this concept and took it one step further and introduced the other two service tiers. let's leave it here. So with this change, there's a set of roles and responsibilities on our end and on the customer end, and it's slightly different than it was before with web and business databases, which is why I'm showing this here. So on our end, obviously, we go down the route of essentially making the promise that we have those resources available when your database runs in it. So we carve out those resources, and it's obviously our responsibility to make sure that you always get those. The other thing that we have to do, we as SQL databases, to provide you tools and insights of how many resources you use. Right? Because it's very hard if you try to run your workload in one of those boxes, you need to know, hey, when do I reach the limits, do I fit in there, etc. And then the last thing that we obviously need to do whenever we make such a change, and it can be a quite dramatic change if you are used to run on web and business into those new service tiers, well, we need to come and educate you, which is essentially why we're here. On the customer side of things, if you think about those new service tiers compared to the old ones, well, the old ones, you just shows, hey, how much size do you think you need? You can even start very small and then change it later on. For the new service tiers, you will go in, and whoever saw the BCDR session yesterday, there are differences in the capabilities of these service tiers. So you first go in and choose the service tier that gives you the functional capabilities that you need. For example, if you just need a simple restore solution, well, and you have a very small load, then the basic databases might be good enough. If you require like readable secondaries in other regions, well, then you're already from a functional perspective in the premium tiers, because this is where we offer this feature set. The second thing then, after you chose the feature set that you need, you need to check which performance level is sufficient to run your load. All right, so this is very important compared to the previous service tiers. The previous service tiers just went in, you just put whatever load you want on it, we will give you as many resources as we can, and you're good to go, essentially, until you hit one of those issues that I described before. Now, in the new service tiers, you need to be aware that there's a limit, and you need to test and plan for it. And the last thing, obviously, after you did the initial sizing, you need to go in and monitor this and make sure that you don't run into trouble. And I'll point out one or two things during the presentation that you can run into and that you need to be aware of. All right. So the first concept I want to talk about is we introduced the database throughput unit. This is a net new concept. And so what this is, it represents the relative power that we give a database. You can imagine that we're running thousands of machines, and over years we replace hardware and we go through different generations, these kind of things. So we want to abstract actual resources to a level, like if you think as a platform as a service, right, you shouldn't think about the hardware and the underlying architecture, or you shouldn't have to think about it at all. So we abstract this away and introduce this concept of a database throughput unit, which is a blended measure out of CPU, log I/O, data file I/O, and memory. So those four resources form this DTU. And if you look at the different DTU levels, and I will show which ones we have, they can be used to compare the relative power, if you will, between those offerings that we have. So you will see later on there's one that has 50 DTUs and there's one that has 100 DTUs. So the one with 100 DTUs roughly gives you double the power of the one that gives you 50 DTUs. And then the last thing that we introduced with the DTUs as well is we changed the monitoring from rather giving you actual numbers, so think of like I/O numbers, IOPS per second, to give you a percentage relative to the limit of the SKU. Right? And this is, again, it's a way of simplifying it and abstracting away the hardware below. People familiar with SQL Server might know like an I/O is actually not always the same thing, right? So what does it really mean to have an I/O? Can be all sorts of things, literally. Like can be very big ones, up to actually a couple megabytes, or it can be like very small pages. So we abstracted this away and we give you a percentage on all four of those dimensions. And I will also show later how to use them. All right, oh, by the way, feel free to ask questions in between if you have any. Anybody? Okay. The next thing that you might have seen if you studied those new service tiers is we have something called the Azure SQL Database Benchmark. So this is a benchmark that we have developed in-house by actually a handful of experts that we have sitting in our teams that used to work on benchmarks before. This benchmark is an example workload that mimics an OLTP workload that we use to define these bounding boxes. And so you can see here, you don't actually need to memorize any of those details. We just want to make sure that we have shown this. So it's like six tables, and we run different read and write workloads against those. And we use, as I said, we use this benchmark, this sample workload, to size the bounding boxes. So what this means is, if you have a bounding box, as I mentioned before, that gives you 50 DTUs, and we have a bounding box that gives you 100 DTUs, this means that this benchmark that we use produced double the transaction rates on the 100 DTUs than it was on the 50 DTUs. Does that make sense? And so this is somewhat important to know, because not all database workloads obviously will look like the workload that we use to set those performance levels. In fact, probably none of our customer workloads look exactly like this. But it's a good representation of it. But it's just something to be aware of. You might not, like your specific application might not get actually double the throughput in the higher tiers, just because this is what we use to set those tiers. And we have to do it this way. Just as I said before, we might change the hardware underneath the system, and we need like a normalization to set those DTU numbers and to size those boxes. This is what we use. That all said, let's have a look at how those performance levels actually look like. So we have seven offerings today. The first one is in basic, and it comes with overall the smallest feature set. And again, if you saw the overview session and the BCDR session yesterday, you will know roughly what the differences are. Basic gets 5 DTUs. And the transaction result that we got running our sample workload is 16,600 transactions over an hour. If you go into the standard service tiers, you see there are three, one with 10, one with 20, and one with 50 DTUs. And you can see the transaction rates in the row below. You can see there we actually measure those transactions over minutes. And then going to our highest performance tiers, the premium performance tiers, there are three levels again with 100, 200, and 800 DTUs. And there you can see we actually give you transaction rates per second. So why do we do these differences? The first thing is we want to make people aware of how we think of those sizes. Right? So if you have a basic database, we want you to know that we don't think you can actually run a mission-critical application that used to run on a Superdome on-premise in those databases. Right? It's actually very much not like this. So we think about it, hey, you know, you have a workload that has a handful of transactions per hour, and it's small, and this is the power you get. The other thing is we guarantee, well, we don't, it's not yet a guarantee, but we strive for giving you these like a certain stability. So you can think of it in premium, actually we shoot for giving you this predictability per second. So we say, hey, every second you should get this. Whereas in basic we say hour over hour you should get this. Right, so there's a slightly conceptual difference between those, and it's like the guarantees get higher the higher you go in the performance levels. Two other things, the size restrictions that you can have in those tiers are a little different. So basic, we give you up to 2 gigs of storage for free. The standard service tiers all get up to 250 gigabytes of storage, which, as I said, are included. And in premium, you can go up to 500 gigabytes. And again, so that's the difference to before. You don't pay for the storage at all anymore, right? It is all included. You only pay for the performance part. And we also, with the introduction of those new service tiers, we went from a daily billing concept to an hourly billing concept. So starting, so the prices that you see right here, they will be starting November 1st to be actually live. We announced them a month ago. So we always have a month of advanced notice. And so you'll see those prices are hourly billed, and if you move between performance levels, you will actually get per hour once you actually hit this performance level. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, because now that we actually constrain you in your workloads, databases go through different phases in their lifetime, right? So if you come in and want to import a database and you have huge amounts of data, then it might take you a while on a smaller performance level to actually import this data and get this data running. Whereas your production workload might actually be fine running at those lower performance levels. So something to think about in this particular scenario is, hey, you actually, if you want to have a fast import to go to a higher performance level and then come back down once you hit or once you're actually done with the import and run it in the appropriate level for your production workload. And certainly also the other way around, right? If you actually don't care that it takes long to import the data and you don't want to pay for that, I'm not sure if that example actually works out from a math perspective. So you might want to do the math there. All right. So I already said we switched to this new concept of resource governance, and I want to give you like an introduction on what is really the difference and what are the key differences to this concept of throttling that we used to have before. So resource governance is done per database. It's not on a machine level, but it is per database. And how this works is we have a governor that essentially allows you to use the resources at a certain rate. So if you think of it like you get transaction or you have a query coming in, this query needs a set of resources on all those dimensions. And what will happen is, well, we will actually let you through in a certain rate, right? And once you got all the resources that it takes to answer the query, essentially we give you back the result. So if you compare two service levels to each other, what is really the difference between them is that on the right-hand side, you see a P1 performance level, and on the left-hand side, an S2 performance level, and you can see that the governor actually allows you to use more resources. So if you put the same query there, well, we will actually allow you to use more of those resources at the same time, and hence your query returns faster. One last important thing to think about, though, is if you overload the system, we will still only give you this initial rate, right? So we will continue processing your data, but you will get queued. Your requests will get queued. So we wouldn't, from our end, we wouldn't kill anything. We will just keep accepting those requests, but you will see a drop in your throughput. And what ultimately can happen in the system, and actually, in fact, in any database, is that you get command timeouts. So the default command timeout when you connect to SQL Server or a SQL database is 30 seconds. And if you overload the system and the system can't keep up with the resource request that you put in by adding more queries, you might see command timeouts just simply because it takes so long for the system to get to process those requests. The other thing that can happen as well in combination with this is that you run out of worker threads. So worker threads basically represent a single query that runs. So each query gets a thread that then executes this query, and there are limits of worker threads as we actually have in web and business today in these new editions. And what can happen is that you start piling up worker threads and they don't free up because the resources are still in use for previous queries, and then you get an error message. That's just something to keep in mind, right? Don't overload the system because your throughput will just go down. And if you do this too much, if you push it too hard, you might run into those limits and actually get error messages. All right. So resource monitoring. We used to have and still do have a view in the logical master database in the service that is called sys.resourcestats. And this view gives you 5-minute averages of your resource utilization of all your databases that belong to this logical server. The second view that we have, and this is the new view that Joe talked earlier about, is a view within the user database called sys.dmdb resource stats. This view gives you averages over 15 seconds of your resource utilization. So you might ask, so why are we doing this? It turns out it is very hard to actually see what your database uses on those 5-minute averages. So you can imagine if you have a workload that runs for 2.5 minutes at full power and then sleeps for 2.5 minutes, well, a 5-minute average will actually give you 50%. But that's not really what happened, right? Really what happened is you ran at 100% and then you ran at zero. So we went in and introduced this 15-second granular data that you can query within the user database, which will obviously give you way better insights into this one. And we know it's still 15 seconds, but we're looking into improving this further. As I said earlier, those percentages are relative to these bounding boxes, right? So you will know when you look at this telemetry data, you will know, hey, I use 50% of my CPU, or I use 50% of my data I/O, right? So you don't actually know I use 16 IOPS, because it doesn't really matter, right? But it's important to know, hey, I have some headroom, or I don't have any headroom anymore. And the last thing, so the first one, the sys.resource.stats, is available in both portals, in the current one and in the new one. And I can actually show you how to opt into those statistics, and you get this graph that is shown on the right-hand side here. The 15-second granular data is also exposed in the new, in this Ibiza portal. However, it's not in the old portal. And another thing that is important at the moment, the 15-second granular data is also not available for web and business databases. All right. So choosing a performance level, there are multiple scenarios around this one. The first one that we often get the question is, hey, I have this on-premise database and I want to move it to the platform as a service offering. Which one is the right one to choose? Today, the answer really is, well, you need to test it. Right? There's really no way other than testing it out. It is important, the approach that we normally tell people is like, hey, like what I talked about earlier, you know, the basic ones, really think of it, well, you have a transaction here and there, right? And then the standard ones is more like, think of a line of business application. This kind of load, and the premium ones are really meant for heavier workloads. So that's a first very rough categorization of those offerings, but it gives you a starting point. And then, as I said, the only way of really finding out, you need to run test workloads and see where you fit. The second thing is migrating from web and business databases. We have a blog post out that gives guidance on how to do this and how to start doing it. And this is basically, you take this telemetry that I talked about on the slide before, and you make an assessment where you will fit. And then you need to, given that we only expose those 5-minute averages for web and business, testing is always also required, but at least it gives you a starting point where you will fit in. The 5-minute averages that we expose in the resource stats view are relative to an S2 performance level. So if you see for a web and business database, you use 50% on all those resources, that means you use 50% of the resources of an S2. Whereas if you see 150%, well, that means you're over the resource limits of an S2 database. And so, as I said, we have a blog post out here, and we have it in the resource section of the slides. We have a link to it. Definitely worth looking at it and get some insights into how you can do this initial sizing. Again, though, testing is required. How to figure out if you need to switch to a different performance level. As I said before, well, you should monitor this 15-second granular data, and if you see, well, you keep hitting the limit, right? You run on one resource at 100% all the time, and you see, well, you realize the throughput is really not acceptable for your database, well, you might want to consider moving up. Same is true, though, for the other way around. So if you run in a P1 performance level, and all those things always say 25%, well, if you don't need the feature set available in premium, you might get away in running it in an S2 performance level. So this goes both ways. One last thing, and I'm not going to go into any details on this one. It is, again, more important to actually look at how do your queries perform. So known troubleshooting, query performance troubleshooting that used to exist in SQL Server that wasn't as important in web and business databases just simply because we gave you all the power we had, right, now become more important again. Maybe you can go in, tweak your queries, and actually fit into a lower performance level and save money. Just something to keep in mind. Changing a performance level is reasonably straightforward. You can then do it, obviously, in the portal, but we support all other APIs that are out there in the service. So you can do it through a REST API. You can use PowerShell. I will show you how to do it in T-SQL. And there's actually also a .NET wrapped wrapper that you can use. So no matter how you want to do it, you can actually integrate it into your application logic if you have these patterns where you can predict you need more performance at some point of time. Well, implement it, and you're good to go. The last thing that I want to cover before the demo is the new quota management. If you're familiar with the service, we always actually had a quota management, which was per subscription, you could get 6 logical servers. And each logical server can get up to 499 databases plus your master. So it's 500. Oh, sorry, 150. There are exceptions that you can get up to 500, my bad. So it's 150 by default. What we introduced on top of that is a DTO quota management. So the DTO quota management, how it works is per logical server, you get 1,600 DTUs that you can distribute across databases. And so this is not you can assign certain amount of power to a database, but this means you can, for example, create 2 P3 databases that both have 800 DTUs, so that sums up to 1,600. You could try to do 160 as zeros. That will also lead to 1,600 DTUs. However, you actually exceed the number of 150 databases. So both quota management systems are still in place. So you have to make sure that you stay below both limits. The 2 more examples. One is if you obviously try to exceed both limits, that wouldn't work. But you can do any mix and match and get to reach either one of those limits. All right, with that, let me switch to the demo. Get locked in. Very good. So you can see here I got 3 databases. And I'm only showing you to actually, like, I'm not doing any tricks here. So there's one that is called P1 that has actually a P1 performance level, and there's one called an S2 that has an S2 performance level. And then the last one, the Fabricam, is a basic. So what I'm going to show you is the first thing that I'm going to show you is a performance test. So this is a function that I've created in the P1 and the S2 databases. And what this function does, it runs through a loop and it calculates something. So it's a memory, it's a CPU intensive calculation. Right? I'm going to call this function from both databases and it will output the time that it took to run through this loop, which is this line at the bottom here. All right, so let me close this. On the left-hand side here is the P1 database, and on the right-hand side is the S2 database. And it's actually this script first. You can see I do the same thing on both sides, right? I'm going to declare a bunch of variables where I store the results. I'm going to execute this function 5 times, and then I'm just going to output the result. And just to see, so this one here queries this 15-second granular data, and just to make, oh, very good. All right, yes, please. Let's connect to the database first. So just to actually show there's nothing going on in the database, you can see this, the result shows all zeros across all those dimensions, except for some memory that I use. Let's actually get connected here too. Sorry, Sorry about the connecting business here. So just to show that the S2 database is also not doing anything, go in here, you can see they're all zeros. Used a little bit of CPU, that was probably my login just now. And let's go in and connect this one to actually run the perf test. That's the P1. Connect. All right, so now I'm going to kick this off, run this query, and I'm going to do the same thing on the S2 side. And hopefully what that will show is a very predictable performance across all those 5 runs that I do, and it will hopefully also show that the S2 takes roughly double the amount of time. So the first thing you can see, it takes about 1,940 milliseconds to run through this loop. You can see I ran the loop 5 times, and it stays within a couple of milliseconds. And you can see on the S2, it's around 3,800, 3,900 milliseconds, and it is also within a reasonable range of milliseconds. And you can see that all of those runs are consistent. So if I run this just again, just to prove the point, if I run it again, it will come back actually in the same amount of milliseconds. All right, while this executes, let's go back and query this view again. And you can see that now this view shows the spikes in the CPU usage that I generated. You see here, it actually doesn't go to 100%. Well, the reason again for this is the test actually runs less than 15 seconds, right? So you will, like, we hide the spike by averaging it out over the 15 seconds, which again, we do realize that's a downside and we try to get better at this one, but this is just what it is. But obviously it is way better than looking at a 5-minute average where the CPU utilization would probably be close to zero. To show this on this one, you can see on the left-hand side, it actually only spends 1 15-second interval. In the S2 case, it spends 2 15-second intervals, but given that I started it within an interval and end within an interval, because again, it doesn't run long enough, you don't see 100% of the utilization. All right, so I hope that proves the point that this is very stable. Going to the changing of a performance level, this is a simple alter database command that you can do, and there are a set of options that you can give it. Here I only specify the additions, so I only say standard, and what will happen there is we will give you the smallest of the performance levels when you execute the statement. You can, however, go directly to one of the other performance levels if you like. You can specify the objective, performance objective, I believe it is called, and get directly to the performance level. And I'm going to do this. I need to be connected to master here, actually. So this works in the master database only. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to change this Fabricam database to which is a basic database, to an S0 database. I shoot this command. The command is successful. It's an asynchronous operation. And if I go back in here, after when we do a reload, which is normally a tricky thing to do, so you would, it will show on the portal that the status is pending unless it is already done. What you can do, you can actually programmatically monitor these operations happening by querying a view. So you can see there are a bunch of databases that used to be in this server before, and the state for the Fabricam is already completed. So I changed the performance level from a basic to an S0, and it was like this. You need to be aware of if you move to higher performance levels, there can be a delay, and there, in fact, for the most time, is a delay. And this is especially if you move upwards, which is a size of data operation. So it can happen, and Bill explained this in the overview session already, that we need to move data around. We need to find a spot for your database to fit in, and this just can take a while. And if you have a huge database, well, then potentially we need to copy some data around, and this just can take a while. Just something to be aware of. But you can go in, pull, as I did querying this view, you can pull the data and see when did the operation finish. All right, with that, let me hand it over back to Joseph, and let's hear about scale out.
Thank you very much, Jan. So within Elasticscale, just want to give you a little picture of the journey of our team. We've been in public preview since October 2nd, so coming up on 1 month now. And previous to that, we were in private preview with a handful of internal and external customers working through the scenarios and the bits before we released it publicly. So within Elasticscale, there's really a number of application patterns that necessitate the need for Elasticscale. As Jan talked about, we enable a database to scale up to a P3 service tier level. But what happens when your workload is more than a P3? You don't really want to turn customers away, and you really want the conveniences of a PaaS offering. We've introduced Elasticscale, which enables you to scale your workload out across many different databases. And we've introduced as a client library is the first step to this and some management services, and we'll go into more details. So if we kind of relate back to the demo that we saw at the beginning of the presentation, we simulated the scale up just from basic to S0, and then we scaled out to be able to add multiple databases to our application. And the real value prop of Elasticscale is that that scale out is transparent to the application. You just write the application one way, and it's shard aware. And we'll go into the details of that. So there's a number of reasons why you'd want to scale out, either for capacity reasons, you have an application that's bigger than 500 gigabytes, performance, you have an application that's more than what a P3 can offer, or you have geolocality requirements. And this is a very popular topic within the planet right now and creating globally aware apps, that data can't transfer between, say, Europe and United States boundaries or Australia or Asia. So actually being able to have a single application that can keep databases in each geographical region and be able to route connections to those particular databases without having to stamp out multiple applications. Or simply for isolation or for security reasons. You might say, and this kind of comes into the application types, and the first one is single tenant and saying, hey, my security requirements for my application require for a SaaS provider and ISV provider say that each one of my customers has to be in their own individual database for compliance reasons. But stamping out an application stack for every single database is not realistic, right? You want to create one application that is customer aware, so we're just going to route you to the correct database for each customer. So that's the single tenant model. There's also multi-tenant too, and you say, hey, you know, I have 100,000 customers, I'm not going to make 100,000 databases. The cogs of that is just impractical. So what we're actually going to do is logically stack a bunch of customers within a single database, a multi-tenant scenario, and we'll logically partition the customers by what we call the sharding key or distribution key, and make that a little bit more cost effective. And playing off those first two scenarios, we also see what is a hybrid model, where you can actually do both. So you might have that hook offer, that free trial, that says, hey, why don't you try out our application for 30 days? It's much more economical, and you maybe don't need the performance isolation and all the capacity guarantees for the free offer, so you're going to put those tenants in a multi-tenant database. They say, oh, well, once you upgrade, then we're going to move you over to your own database, or you know, whether it's a basic, an S0, or a P1. Depending on your scenario. So there's kind of a little bit of play between multi-tenant and hybrid. Also, in the demonstration that we show of the Coke bottles, which is hopefully still running, we also have this temporal pattern of data, especially with the Internet of Things scenario, where people want to log great deals of either structured or semi-structured data into a relational store or other stores, but if relational is the spot where you want to keep the data and keep a single data model, you fill up that database in 500 gigabytes, okay, well, great. I want to be able to now shard that data over time. So instead of using a customer ID as your sharding key, you use date, and you can shard horizontally as well. And then again, geopolitical or geolocality scenarios. So those are really the motivations for why scale-out technology is necessary in this day and age. So when we think about scaled out, and this is just kind of a step through of how this logically thinks and introduce the terminology, we come to the conclusion that our single database just is not sufficient for our applications. We start off with our database, we say, ah, this is not good enough. So the first natural question is to say, okay, if we were going to shard this data or this across multiple databases, how do we think about doing this? Well, we usually look at our tables and say, you know, which column or which table should we shard and which what makes the most sense? And it's usually very applicable to take the customer ID and say, oh, the first 100 customers go on this database, the first 100 customers go on that database. So when we do that, we introduce this concept of what we call as a sharding key. And this is, again, this is the token, if you will, of what will identify the database on which that particular customer's data resides. So we say, okay, we're going to use customer ID, and then we're going to shard this over many databases. The second we introduce multiple databases in our application, we need to be aware of the global state of where this data resides. There always has to be that master that that keeps the record of, ah, we know the data is in this database for these customers, and so on for the rest of the databases we have. So for that, we've introduced the concept of what is called the Shard Map Manager. Shard Map Manager keeps that global state, and it itself is just a standalone Azure SQL database. And in the demo we saw, and we'll come back to it, that was the head node that kept track of the visualization. So once we have databases and we've stamped those out horizontally, we call these shards, and then the culmination of all the shards together becomes the shard set. And that's the, you can think of set notation or set theory. It's can be one or many of these databases. And within that shard set, you have your sharded table, which again, it comes back to the customer table. This is the table we've decided to shard. And you can shard multiple tables and can get very complicated or very simple depending on your application. We also have the concept of what is a reference table. So when you shard in the current implementation of ElasticScale, the predominant workload is still going to happen on an individual database. The concepts of cross-database transaction or cross-database queries are not present. So what you're really thinking about with reference tables is, hey, if I want to do that join with customers, with orders, and with data centers, that reference table exists on that same database. And then again, this isn't a sharded table, this is a replicated table for each shard. It may only be a couple hundred rows and doesn't necessitate that scale out feature. And then lastly, the smallest atomic unit within ElasticScale is called a shard lit. And this is really all the data that is applicable to a specific sharding key. So in this scenario, you know, customer ID data 1, everything that has that shard lit ID 1 is a logical box. And when we talk about data movement between shards, this is kind of that small bucket that we use to move data. And again, if anybody has any questions, I'd more than happy to take them now if that helps clear up some understanding throughout the presentation. Just yell them out at me, I don't care. So within ElasticScale, we've had two target personas. We have the .NET application developer, which we'll use on the left-hand side of the screen. And then on the right-hand side of the screen, we have your DevOps admin persona. And once you have more than one database, you know that it becomes more challenging to manage those databases in groups. So we've added some services there to help in that process. So the technologies that we're going to talk about within ElasticScale, there's really three basic technologies. The first is shard map management, which is the slide that we just built on, is what is that metadata store that keeps track of where all the data resides? The second is what we call data-dependent routing. Data-dependent routing is a set of APIs that allows us to create a connection to a specific shard or a database, if you will, given a particular customer ID or a particular sharding ID. And the last one is multi-shard query, which is really a fan-out query that allows us to run the same T-SQL statement on multiple databases and return back one union all result set. And we'll go through the scenarios for each one of those. Within the management services, we've implemented what is called a split merge service. And this really allows us to do capacity management or performance management within an individual shard. And what that helps us do is say, oh, well, we have customers 0 through 100 on this shard. We want to split this in half because we've looked at our DMVs and the performance is hit 100%, we think we need two databases for this workload. We've also introduced other facilities that we have linked to too, but I'm not going to spend too much time talking about them today. So coming back to the Shard Map Manager, again is this global state, and we have two types of concepts within the Shard Map Manager that are called shard maps. And this is kind of your logical container that group your databases together. So within the shard maps, we have what is called the range map, which allows you to specify contiguous ranges of values. So as we have shown here, this would be a prime example of a range map where a range of data exists on database one, a range of data exists on database two, and so on. The other is called the list. And this is more applicable for when you're using a GUID as a sharding key, because if you're randomly generating GUIDs, they don't fit in nice, tidy ranges like an integer value does. And then four types of sharding keys. We have int, big int, var binary, and unique identifier or GUID. So the way that these are constructed together is you have the concept which is a shard map, which is just really a table. In this scenario, it's called range shard map. You have the databases that participate as part of this shard map. And then the third table in the shard mappings, you have the ranges that are attributed to that database as part of that shard map. So it's kind of a three-tier grouping of data. And the really nice thing about the shard map manager, it's a very flexible, malleable metadata store that really allows you to craft your application the way that you want it to fit. So imagine we scale out to six databases, and we say for the seventh database, you know, the first 100 customers we have of either not using as much resources as we thought, or they all upgraded to premium and they went to a different range, then we can attribute the next range, 700 through 8 or 600 through 700 to database one. It's not a very constrained a mechanism. It's very flexible to enable for multiple scenarios. So that's the Shard Map Manager. And again, this is just a standalone Azure SQL database. So the next concept that we have is called data-dependent routing. And this is really for that scenario. You say, hey, select star from customers where customer ID equals 104. I want to be routed within my application to the database that contains customer ID 104. So, and I'll show you the APIs in a second that do that. So this becomes a very, very canonical scenario within sharded applications of you're going to run a workload for a particular customer, and you want to get routed to that particular shard. So the APIs, if you've done any .NET programming, they're very, very familiar. Actually, we've only just augmented one little piece in this particular example. Is we have a shard map object, and this is really that object that communicates with the shard map manager. And off that, we have a method called open connection for key, and we specify the sharding key, which again would be an integer representation of 104 for our example, the connection string for that group of shards. And we have some validation options, and it just returns us back a SQL connection no different than any other ADO.NET SQL connection. So we can go forth from here and implement a SQL command, do our select star query, and then we get a data reader back no different than if you were programming against one database. So the experience is very, very familiar, just a small augmentation in the SQL connection. So If you think about this and you're thinking a little bit more critically, you say, great, Joe, that's fantastic. But what if I have 10,000 databases and I have a very huge application and you're going to make me route all these connections through the Shard Map Manager? Doesn't that quickly become the bottleneck of the application? It does. And for this reason, we've introduced a caching scheme within the client. And the way that this works is that the Shard Map Manager has the global view. It has the global state of your application. And each shard has what we call a local shard map, right? It knows what values are on its individual database. So when the client connects to the Shard Map Manager, there's a number of options that you can specify. One being eager, saying that, hey, when I connect to the Shard Map Manager, I want to cache all the shard mappings in the client memory, which enables for the client, next time it creates that connection, doesn't have to consult the Shard Map Manager. It just consults its cache and then creates a connection to the database. That saves on that round trip time to the Shard Map Manager. And we also have the option of lazy, saying, hey, I have a huge shard map. I don't want to muck up my memory footprint. I only want to cache the connections that I'm using in this particular client application. So either one is available. And you think about this the next step a little bit more critically, and you say, ah, Joe, well, what happens if I do a split? I thought the world looked like this. Now you did a split. Now these ranges exist on two databases. How's the application? Do I have to build that logic into my application? The answer is no. When the client connects between the client and the local shard map, it'll do a validation to say, here's the data I think you have. Do you have this data? If it says no, you naturally get a cache miss. The client will go back to the shard map manager and then refresh the cache. So that's all that happens within the APIs. No necessary or not necessary to have to implement that yourself. So the next technology is called multi-shard query. And multi-shard queries really helps us with those questions of saying, you know, very natural once you have a sharded environment and you're running a customer app to say, well, how many customers do I really have? And I don't really want to have to write this iterative loop to go through all my shards all the time to try to answer these questions. So we've created an API set, which is a little bit more of an augmentation than SQL connection, but to be able to answer these questions very easily. And again, this returns a union all result set. It's not a global query. It's a concatenation of result sets. So the canonical scenario here is saying, hey, I want to execute select count star from every single one of my databases and return a single data reader that I can parse through the results. And we'll show a little bit of a demonstration on this later. So the APIs look very similar to SQL connection. We've created a multi-shard connection. We've created a multi-shard command and then a multi-shard data reader, which behaves very similar to the regular SQL data reader. So the concepts are still true to the SQL connection and that same coding workflow, just you're dealing with multiple shards. As you can see in the multi-shard connection, we pass in off that shard map object, get all shards. You can also pass in a subset of shards as well. Say, hey, I just care about, you know, I know the first six shards of my free trial offers. I just want to pass in that list of those six shards to understand how many trial offer customers I have right now. And now switching over to the admin side, one point before we leave this, these client libraries are distributed via NuGet. So they're just a very simple reference into your project, and then you just you incorporate and go. So they're very simple, either bootstrap or integration experience. We have some documentation on our website. The management service experience, and this is kind of an interesting concept within Azure SQL Database and actually very unique within Azure, is that we've actually released these also via a NuGet package, but what you get is a CS project file where you're actually deploying the service within your own subscription. So it gives you the maximum amount of flexibility and predictability within the service. Is one comparison, the IE service, if you've ever used it, import-export within Azure SQL Database, that's a multi-tenant service where multiple people are doing multiple workloads. And if you have some business-critical operations that you'd like to perform and somebody else has the same desire at the same time, it can get resource contention problems, unpredictability. So we've released the management service, Split Merge, as your own deployable service within your subscription. Again, there's no, with the Elasticscale APIs and with the management service, there's no cost associated with any of these. The only cost you incur is in the use of the database or the use of the worker and web role. So what the management service of Split Merge allows us to do is say, hey, we have these two databases, 0 through 100 and, you know, database 1 and database 2, and we looked at the DMVs and we're really not utilizing these anymore, and we've actually dropped them down to basics. We're still not utilizing them anymore. Let's merge this data together. So the Split Merge will enable you to say, choose database A, choose database B, merge them together to create new one database. In the same respects, you can also go to a database, say database 5, and say, hey, we're just pegging this thing. Way too much workload. We've already scaled up to a P3, or maybe, you know, depending on what your scenario is. And we say, hey, let's just split these two in half. We'll create two databases, and then the result is, you know, database 5.1 and 5.2. And if we relate back to the client APIs, as this occurs, the application is actually agnostic to this happening. It takes it in stride using the concepts of both caching and the shard map manager. So when each of these operations are performed, they're actually persisted in the shard map manager, that global state for where our data resides. So one important point to note within Elastic Scale is that really the shards that you get within your sharded application are all just regular vanilla Azure SQL databases. You get the full-fledged functionality, feature support, tooling support that goes within your shard set. And it's not uncommon if you had a sharded data set where database one would be a premium, database two would be a basic, standard, and so on, and you can change those within the lifetime of the application. So you can scale up and down individual shards for predictable performance, but you can also scale out for consistent and predictable capacity as well. And then you get the same, you know, backup restore, GODR, auditing for each of these shards, as well as integration with all the tooling that we have too. So you can connect to these shards no different than any other database. So with that, I want to come back to the demo. And hopefully that this provides a little bit more context for what we saw in the demo. Okay. So as you can see, as we were away, we provisioned a number of databases, actually quite a few databases. And you can see we scaled those up to an S0, and we hit that workload for S0, we scaled out as well. And with, so I don't know how many we created, a great number just within the time of this presentation. So the blue circle, although it's distorted now, is our Shard Map Manager database. That orange triangle represents our shard map, and then each one of these databases are our shards. And as you can see, one of these is still pumping data somewhere. Hopefully it'll turn red soon. You can see in the top right-hand corner, we can see that the cost of this data tier per hour, this is costing us 12 cents per hour as for all these databases. So there's some interesting games you can play depending on your workload of what the appropriate addition is and then how you want to scale out. So I want to show within this. So just to make sure that you see this is real, these are all the shards that we've been creating. So during the course of the presentation, we created 18 shards. And you can see that we have our one shard map manager database. And we've reduced all these to basic. Right? And then within SSMS, we can connect to our databases. We'll refresh this. And we can see that we have all of our databases present. And we can say, hey, let's connect to shard 15, for instance. Run a query against it. So we can see that during the course of this event, our end log target wrote about 4,200 events to that particular shard. And there's our sharding schema. In this case, we're using a sharding key of an integer representation of time based off of the date and 10-second intervals to represent what individual data pieces get written to that particular shard. And the last thing that I want to show is actually the use of our .NET APIs to do a multi-shard query across all these databases that we provisioned during the course of the presentation. So as we can see, it's just a very basic console app, and there's just some configuration, some app setting passwords that we took in. So we create the shard map object, and from that we create a range shard map, and then we just use this multi-shard connection and then use our SQL data reader to print the results to the screen. So if we do an F5 of that, what this will do, we just did that select star count from each of our databases that we created during the presentation to return that one result set. So now we can say, hey, on each of these shards, this is how many records I wrote or how many customers that we had on each of those shards. And it becomes a very quick experience to be able to program against a number of shards. In the same token, we could use the data-dependent routing APIs to program to a specific shard as well. So with that said, that is the culmination of the presentation. I invite any questions, and I'll switch back to the obligatory screens. So related content, we will be around at the booth all day. We might not be wearing the same t-shirts, but we'll be there from 6:30 to 8 tonight. And if anybody is really interested in any of this stuff, we'd really love to talk more to you. If anybody is interested for the NLog target as a logging facility to do scale out for, say, maybe a bunch of web roles that you're running, I'd love to talk to you more about that scenario as well. So the resources, we have a number, Azure SQL Database as kind of the overall arching map. We have our documentation map for Elastic Scale, and we have a very straightforward 5-minute tutorial to how to get started with Elastic Scale. And it's just a Visual Studio sample that has implementation of all the different APIs and kind of walks you through that experience of creating shards, doing DDR operations and multi-shard queries as well. And then, as Jan pointed out earlier, a very important blog for using Azure SQL Database is how to monitor your database using these new real-time performance metrics.
Just the general track resources, probably you've seen this before, same as the resources all up. You please fill out an evaluation, of course, and with that, yeah, we hope you had a good time in this session, and we'll open it up for questions. Yeah. Okay, we're starting in the back, apparently.
Hi. Hi. Yeah. Are you able to shard between multi-logical servers? Because you had an Elastic Scale server and you shard databases inside of this server, but are you able to shard between?
Yes, so the question is, I showed just within one logical server, right? And the question is, can you shard across multiple logical servers? And the question is absolutely yes. You could have one server be in Europe and one server be in the United States, or one server. To the shard map manager and the Elastic Scale APIs, they're actually just SQL servers. You could actually have a couple shards be in IaaS if you wanted to, or perhaps one on-premise if that was your application, and maybe 10 in the cloud. As long as it's a SQL server, the shard map manager doesn't care necessarily where those shards are located. It just becomes then a matter of credential management between all the different shards. But yeah, that's a great question. There's no restrictions on the geolocality or the logical servers. Yes?
We have a question in the front.
Do the limits apply for scale out to the sharding? So
to the shard name?
No, to the maximum number of databases for sharding.
There is no limit to as many databases you want to scale out. That is, it's an open-ended. So you could have 5 databases in your shard map, or you could have 100,000 if that was enabled.
Restricted by the quota management. However, as I kind of like slipped out in the session, you can actually get higher limits. So if you get in touch with us and you say, well, I need not 6 servers but 100,000 servers, then we're going to work with you through how to achieve this.
Yes, sir.
What about for support for Entity Framework?
Yes, so that's a great question. So support for Entity Framework within Elastic Scale. And we actually see quite a number of our customers using Entity Framework. Within the documentation map, there's actually some great examples and integration of how to do a code-first sharded experience. And it's actually, we have an internal customer that's using that. And it's really brilliant because you can get going with an amazing amount of power and flexibility with very little code actually to write. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of guidance on Entity Framework, and we see that pattern pretty popular.
Anyone else?
Again, please don't hesitate. Yeah. Come up afterwards. We'll be at the happy hour reception tonight, or you know, take our names from the presentation and look us up. We have pretty unique, well, Jan doesn't, but I have a very unique last name. If you have personal emails you want to direct to me, I'd love to learn more about.
My name's unique too. Thank you very much.